The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Tuesday, August 26, 2008. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, the propaganda unit set up to tarnish brand Al-Qaeda.
The kind of example they have in mind is a BBC radio program exposing tensions between Al-Qaeda leadership and its supporters.
A Labour favourite think tank says the government underestimates the value of migrants.
The government, and in conjunction with local councils, should be encouraging them, because it's only when they stay for long periods of time that we get the full economic effects, and a short-term analysis of their skills is short-sighted.
We hear from the people gathering in Denver for the Democratic Convention.
40% of our income tax goes towards the war. Meanwhile, that money could have been spent here in the States.
And Russia's parliament backs independence for South Ossetia and Abkhazia.
The big question is what the Kremlin will do next. It's very hard for the Kremlin to be in favour of separatism in Georgia, but against separatism within the borders of the Russian Federation.
First, a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
A Whitehall counter-terrorism unit is targeting the BBC and other media organisations as part of a new global propaganda push designed to taint the Al-Qaeda brand, according to a secret Home Office paper seen by The Guardian. The document also shows Whitehall counter-terrorism experts will use new media websites and outlets as part of their campaign. The strategy is being conducted by the Research, Information and Communication Unit, which was set up last year by the then Home Secretary John Reid to counter Al-Qaeda propaganda at home and overseas. The disclosure is likely to raise fresh concerns about official news management in a highly sensitive area. There'll be more on this story later in Guardian Daily. The wife of Democratic Party candidate Barack Obama has given the first keynote address of the party's convention in Colorado. In it, Michelle Obama joined party leaders praising her husband's values, dedication to family and leadership. Later this week, in front of a crowd of 80,000 people, Mr. Obama will formally accept the Democrat nomination to run against the Republican candidate John McCain in November. The party hopes the convention will help heal the divisions which appeared during the primary race. A Ryanair flight carrying British holidaymakers has been forced to make an unscheduled landing due to a loss of cabin pressure. Ryanair's website confirmed that flight FR9336 from Bristol to Barcelona-Girona Airport was hit by a depressurisation incident last night. The plane was diverted to Limoges in central France, and 16 passengers were taken to hospital with earache. In a statement, the company said the loss of pressure caused the oxygen masks on board to deploy and that the plane was diverted as a safety precaution. Sport in last night's Premiership action. Manchester United came out winners in a rematch of the FA Charity Shield against Portsmouth. A first half goal by Darren Fletcher secured the 3 points. Meanwhile, United's manager Sir Alex Ferguson's being touted as a possible manager for a Great Britain football team. Sports Minister Jerry Sutcliffe says Sir Alex would be the best candidate to coach a GB squad at the 2012 Olympics. In today's papers, The Times is leading with coverage of the Democratic Party convention. It says Senator Ted Kennedy, who's recovering from a brain tumour, led the party with a call to arms, calling Barack Obama America's hope and dreams. The Telegraph says there are concerns that a flagship government database intended to protect vulnerable children could be used by police to search for evidence of crime in what the paper calls a shocking extension of its original purpose. And finally, most of the papers have pictures on the back pages of the UK's Olympic medalists enjoying heroes and heroines' welcomes as they return from Beijing.
First, during the Second World War, Allies dropped propaganda leaflets from aeroplanes onto their enemies. These days, the tactics are a little more sophisticated. The government has set up a counter-terrorism resource, the Research, Information and Communications Unit, the RICU, to counteract the message put out by extremists. Its emphasis is to tarnish brand Al-Qaeda. The Guardian's Home Affairs editor Alan Travis explains how the unit came about.
Yes, it was set up and established under the dying days of John Reid's period as Home Secretary, after the Home Office had been split in half and focused more sharply on counter-terrorism and a sort of Ministry of the Interior. And it brings together senior officials from Home Office, Foreign Office, and the Department of communities and local government. And its role is as a counter-terrorism unit to as a propaganda unit, really, in a shadowy sort of way. One step in, it's not secret in that they've announced its existence, but its activities have been somewhat wreathed in mystery. And it's designed to, in its own words, taint the Al-Qaeda brand, and that's its task.
And how is it going about this?
Well, what this paper I've seen, which was drawn up in July, shows, which is entitled Challenging Violent Extremist Ideology Through Communications, is that it's intending to, or is already underway, is a sort of global propaganda push whereby it's collating material from news sources around the world, Arabic, North African and Western media sources, along the theme of Al-Qaeda is in decline, and is, in its own words, pushing this material initially to the Foreign Office's overseas posts, all consulates and embassies in the world, for use with to influence what they call overseas influencers and opinion formers, but also in a domestic context as well, and it intends to use this material to push it, is the word, pushing is the word they use in the document, this material to UK media channels. And the kind of example they have in mind is a BBC radio program exposing tensions between Al-Qaeda leadership and its supporters, which starts raising serious questions, I think, in terms of a shadowy Whitehall counterterrorism propaganda unit pushing material to established news organisations such as the BBC, presumably on an unattributable basis, and raises questions about news management in a very sensitive area.
Does the RICU believe that its tactics are working? Is Al-Qaeda losing supporters?
Well, this is an initiative which has only just started. This is the first of what it calls will be a rolling product, in the terminology of the counterterrorism experts, tailored to attempting to, in their words and jargon, undermine the Al-Qaeda narrative, which they think they need to do by countering it with an alternative narrative. And the material they put together is interesting in that it documents and illustrates three themes. One, first of all, that Al-Qaeda is losing support. Secondly, that Al-Qaeda are not heroes and don't have the answers. And in an overseas context, that Al-Qaeda harms you, your country, and your livelihood. And the material which it puts together brings together a lot of articles and news reports based on along those themes. For example, it under the heading Al-Qaeda has suffered military defeat in, it has a note in brackets there to diplomatic handlers saying, use advisedly, avoid suggesting that Al-Qaeda is no longer a threat. We're not claiming victory over Al-Qaeda, we're stressing their declining support. And so, for example, it cites the recent claims by Michael Hayden, the CIA director, that Al-Qaeda is essentially defeated in Iraq and Saudi Arabia and on the offensive throughout much of the rest of the world, in what they describe, this briefing note describes as a strikingly upbeat assessment of the organization. But the rest of the material is coherent and credible, and goes through such things as citing leading clerics in Egypt, other parts of the Arabic world, distancing themselves or denouncing Al-Qaeda in various ways.
And picking up on one of the points you made earlier, has the BBC signed up to make politically biased programmes?
Well, there's no evidence of that has happened as yet. What it shows is that this organisation, this shadowy Whitehall counterterrorism unit, is about to or already has opened talks with the BBC and or other UK mainstream media organisations to use this material. It's very early days still. What this document I've seen shows is that this is in the planning stage, and they're presumably this dossier of material has been sent or is being sent to embassies around the world and will be subject part of a propaganda push, which I presume will happen in the next few weeks or the next couple of months.
For more analysis, go to guardian.co.uk/terrorism. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, a leaked memo shows a warning about property tax. The leaked details at guardian.co.uk/money. Car companies which don't meet emission targets are named and shamed at guardian.co.uk/business. Sean Connery is back in Scotland for the Edinburgh Book Festival. The full story at guardian.co.uk/books. And the firefighter games kick off. Hoses at the ready, that's at guardian.co.uk/sport. To America now, where it's the second day of the Democratic National Convention in Denver. The theme for the opening day was One Nation, with speakers including Barack Obama's wife Michelle and former President Jimmy Carter. Today, it's Hillary Clinton's turn. Political columnist Martin Kettle is in Denver's Pepsi Center for The Guardian.
Please join me in welcoming an impassioned public servant, a loving daughter, wife, and mother, and our nation's next First Lady, Michelle Obama.
Well, I've just come out of the convention centre, which is absolutely packed tonight. Everybody is saying it's the heaviest attendance at the first day of a national convention for many, many years, probably since the 1970s. Tremendous atmosphere in there. It was a big risk, I think, having Michelle Obama making the first keynote speech of the Democratic convention here. She's a fairly unknown quantity to most Democrats, let alone to most voters, most ordinary Americans. So, you know, she was having to pack a tremendous amount into quite a short 20-25 minute speech at the end of the evening. Basically, her job there was to try, I think, to persuade people that the candidate that they're going to choose is the man they think he is, that he is somebody they can really have confidence in, and that her backstory and his backstory amount to something that all Americans can share in, because obviously a very, very big and largely here unspoken dimension of all this is the race question and the nomination of the first ever African-American to be presidential candidate in the United States.
What struck me when I first met Barack was that even though he had this funny name, and even though he had grown up all the way across the continent in Hawaii, his family was so much like mine. He was raised by grandparents who were working class folks just like my parents, and by a single mother who struggled to pay the bills just like we did. And like my family, they scrimped and saved so that he could have opportunities that they never had for themselves. And Barack and I were raised with so many of the same values. Like, you work hard for what you want in life. That your word is your bond, that you do what you say you're gonna do. That you treat people with dignity and respect, even if you don't know them, and even if you don't agree with them.
Michelle Obama's key theme was her family and her background and her rootedness, and she made a very, very particular point about saying how deeply proud she was of the country. I think she touched all those kind of bases to reassure people that she is an ordinary but obviously extraordinary person who would be the kind of First Lady the whole country can relate to.
My piece of the American dream is a blessing hard won by those who came before me. All of them, driven by the same conviction that drove my dad to get up an hour early each day to painstakingly dress himself for work. The same conviction that drives the men and women I've met all across this country. The military families who say grace each night with an empty seat at the table. The servicemen. The servicemen and women who love this country so much, they leave those they love most to defend it. The young people across America serving our communities, teaching children, cleaning up neighborhoods, caring for the least among us each and every day. People like Hillary Clinton.
This convention is mainly about Barack Obama, obviously, but it is also about how to deal with the Hillary Clinton inheritance, because she made such a very, very strong showing in the primaries and very, very nearly won the nomination. So, you know, that's all got to be finessed, dealt with in a very sensitive way. I thought that the Obama camp, in the shape of Michelle Obama, made a very graceful tribute to Hillary Clinton by singling her out first as somebody to identify with in her speech. So, you know, the ground is now set for a reciprocal gesture. That's what the organizers will be hoping for. They'll want Hillary Clinton to not just to endorse Barack Obama, but to do so with warmth and generosity and a real sense of the occasion, which, you know, being here tonight, what really struck me was this is a historic convention because, you know, this party is about to elect a black presidential candidate and a black presidential first lady candidate, if you want to call her that. And that's never happened. And, you know, you notice it, and everybody notices it. They find it difficult to talk about in racial terms, but they're proud as anything about the sense of looking forward that this all represents. And Hillary Clinton mustn't rain on that parade.
Martin Kettle. And you can read more news, comment, blogs and analysis from The Guardian's US election team at guardian.co.uk/America. One of Labour's favourite think tanks, the Institute for Public Policy Research, the IPPR, claims we're missing out on migrant talent. It says the government has underestimated their worth to local communities and employers. By only staying short periods, the UK is losing new ideas, ways of working and the entrepreneurial spirit. Analysis shows that patents increase when migration does. The Guardian's political correspondent Allegra Stratton has the details.
It's felt like in previous months that both parties are sort of clamouring to limit immigration in some way. And we've had a few government ministers come out, not just in the last few months, but in sort of last 6 months, talking about limits to immigration so that local councils can control the allocation of services and resources, because there are some people who are naturally Labour-leaning who are feeling that they're not getting their fair share of resources. So it's not just a Conservative call to limit immigration. There's also sort of some sense that Labour would like to do it too. But the IPPR have, and as you say, they're a left-leaning think tank. They're very close to the government and have been for the last decade. They've come out with a report that, well, it's a preliminary report. The actual thing's not out till next month. And they are saying that the economic effect of immigration is much larger than either the Conservatives or Labour have hitherto thought. Things like the creativity that immigrants bring to a community and the trade that they open up with their countries of origin shouldn't be underestimated and are being underestimated at the moment.
So simply put, the government's figures don't make room for entrepreneurs, do they? Which is an area that Gordon Brown is particularly keen to encourage.
Yes, simply put, at the moment, the skills-based system that we have in this country means you have to come along and say, I have these skills at the moment. And the research that the IPPR has found from California and from Germany and other parts of America, it shows that what about those skills that you could develop along the line that immigrant communities in all of these places they've been looking at have also developed along the line. So in effect, it's kind of the sort of inventive capacity of immigrant communities has been underestimated. And they point to quite interesting examples in California, where with an immigrant community, you actually have a greater number of patents. So i.e. inventions and new things being developed, the number of them is greater if you're in an immigrant community.
Do we gather from this report that the IPPR is keen to keep migrants here for longer?
Their analysis of the number of immigrants that have come to the UK since 2004 is that half of them have left since then. So we're not retaining them. So the broad thrust of most anti-immigration campaigners like Migration Watch is that, you know, we're swamped and that there's a sort of increasing wave of immigrants coming our way. And they're saying, well, actually, we don't keep them and local councils should do more to keep them. That actually the government and in conjunction with local councils should be encouraging them, because it's only when they stay for long periods of time that we get the full economic effects. And a short-term analysis of their skills is short-sighted.
Is there a problem with the system, the managed migration system, as is? Do the IPPR want to change that?
I think the IPPR would like to have skills assessed in a different way. They drew my attention to, apparently, students who want to come and study in this country are going to have to be able to prove that they've got £9,600 in their bank account. The IPPR say this is madness. Or the effect of patenting, the effect of these students coming along, studying physics, coming up with some new ideas, patenting an idea, will be gone if you're saying to kids, well, unless you've got 10 grand, you can't come to this country. So I think they do have problems with the technocracy that's being brought in to try and manage migration at the moment.
The Guardian's political correspondent Allegra Stratton. Both houses of Russia's parliament have urged the president to recognise the independence of Georgia's breakaway regions of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. The EU has responded by saying it strongly supports Georgia's territorial integrity. Luke Harding is in Tbilisi for The Guardian. He says Kremlin insiders are playing a shrewd game.
I think it's part of a Kremlin strategy to support these two breakaway regions of Georgia, while at the same time trying to kind of undermine Mikhail Saakashvili, Georgia's president, whom the Kremlin absolutely kind of loathes and has compared repeatedly to Hitler and accused of genocide. Now, I think the interesting thing about these votes, there's no surprise that they've voted for the independence of Kazakhstan and South Ossetia, but the big question is what the Kremlin will do next, because previously it's refused to sort of recognize their independence and has preferred to sort of use this as a sort of way of destabilizing Georgia, if you like, and making life difficult for its government. But I think what Russia will try and do is to try and say that following what happened in Kosovo earlier this year when Kosovo became independent, that South Ossetia and Abkhazia have a perfectly good claim and should become sort of fully fledged states of their own. I suspect, however, that Europe and the US, who've been dismayed basically at Russia's invasion of Georgia, will not go along with this.
With the Kremlin backing this independence, do they not open the door to problems if other states wish to break away, such as the Chechen Republic?
Well, you might indeed say that. I mean, you know, the Kremlin has fought sort of two very brutal, very nasty wars in Chechnya, one in the 90s and one 5 years ago, basically to sort of crush and kill off the sort of separatist rebellion in Chechnya. And in a sense, that is the problem intellectually. I mean, it's very hard for the Kremlin to be, you know, in favor of separatism in Georgia, but against separatism within the borders of the Russian Federation. So I think that is in the back of their minds. But, you know, I mean, basically, Russia's invaded Georgia, Russians occupied Georgia, and really, what has the West done about it? I mean, it's kind of, it's made a fuss, it says it doesn't like it, but practically this doesn't change anything on the ground. And I can tell you from where I am, it's still possible to drive half an hour from downtown Tbilisi and, you know, say hello to the Russian soldiers. They're still here. They haven't gone anywhere.
Well, finally, Luke, tell us then, you've been in a helicopter trip looking over the scene there. What have you been seeing?
Well, I had a very jolly trip on over the weekend, and I went to sort of basically see the Black Sea port of Poti, where the Russians still are. And had a look around at the naval base there. Now the Russians have sunk four ships there and the Coast Guard vessel. And I went inside the main Coast Guard building, which had been absolutely kind of ransacked with filing cabinets turned upside down. And rather amusingly, one Russian soldier had left a message on a whiteboard scrawled in Cyrillic and red pen, which said, "Die, Georgian bitches." And someone else had stamped on a portrait of Mikhail Saakashvili and sort of written the word dick over it. So, I mean, I think this gives you some idea of the kind of sentiment among the kind of the ordinary Russian soldiers towards Georgia. Although, of course, Russia now insists that these soldiers who 2 days ago were regular soldiers are now peacekeepers. They've all kind of put blue helmets on and are apparently keeping the peace. But the sense I get from the Georgians who've been demonstrating and protesting is that they don't regard them as peacekeepers at all. They regard them as occupiers, and they want them to go home.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Finally, we're racking up the air miles as we travel back to Denver, where the city's population has been swelled by tens of thousands of delegates, reporters, protesters and police. Extra officers from neighbouring cities and states have been drafted in to help maintain order. Guardian Daily's Ben Green has more from downtown Denver.
Now, depending on who you believe, there's been an influx of around 75 to 100,000 people here to the Mile High City, so-called because, quite literally, it is a mile above sea level. Every single one of the 17,000 hotel rooms has been booked, the restaurants and coffee shops are fit to bursting, and you can't get a rental car for love nor money. But that doesn't matter, because people this year are being encouraged to walk or indeed cycle to the convention in a bid to cut down their emissions.
My name's Anna Hobbs. I am a volunteer from Humana. I'm here working with the freewheeling program we're doing with Bikes Belong. Well, Humana and Bikes Belong are bringing 1,000 bikes to the Democratic National Convention and also to the Republican National Convention as a way to highlight what's good for your body and what's good for the environment. It was a bike partisan effort, so we're doing it for both the Republican and the National Convention. So, you know, Obama and McCain, we'd encourage both of them to get on a bike and ride.
I'm currently about a mile away from the conference center in downtown Denver, where it's just full of noise, color, and spectacle. There are people absolutely everywhere you look. But one thing you can't help but notice is the huge police presence around the town. There are teams in rather fetching black outfits on their mountain bikes, There are armed patrols in riot gear and sunglasses on almost every corner, looking incredibly intimidating. You can hear the whirring of the police choppers above my head. It's a constant presence everywhere you go. This show of force is every bit the contradiction that Americans are paying for the price of their freedom. The anti-war movement is certainly out here in force in Denver. And on one rally and a march that I went to observe earlier today, it really encapsulated the mood that people here are desperate for a change. And for those here in Denver at least, they're hoping it's Barack Obama who can bring it.
I'm Jean Stevens from Code Pink, Women for Peace, and I'm from New York City. Many Americans, most Americans, are very upset about the economy right now. A recent Gallup poll came out earlier this month that said the economy was the number one worry and priority for most Americans right now. But the truth is this war has been going on for the past 6 years, and 40% of our income tax goes towards the war. So much money has been just sort of pumped into Iraq, and we don't really see much good it's been doing. And meanwhile, that money could have been spent here in the States. You know, and our economy would be fine if we didn't have such a huge pressure on it, you know, for the war.
That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 BST. Producing today, Phil Maynard and Sonia Rothwell. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.